Hello, and welcome to The Psychonaut Show with Dr. JKB. This is John K. Burton, MD, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. And on this podcast, your captain on these voyages to explore strange new worlds in inner space. At the end of season one, we had taken our journey from neutrality to active curiosity, from optimal frustration to the transitional space, and from spring to fall. We are still taking this winter hibernation to work on season two, but we are now halfway to spring and the days are starting to get lighter. It is the Celtic festival of Imolg, where we start saying goodbye to winter and start welcoming the new things coming this year. And I think it is the perfect occasion to bring you this special bonus episode, my interview with Dr. Clarice Kestenbaum, a real-life Wonder Woman, as you will see. So in this episode of The Psychonaut Show, we're going to have our very first interview, and I'm very, very excited to be here with my training director from back in the 1990s. And for me, time stopped in 1990. I don't know about you, Dr. K, but I'm here with Dr. Clarice Kestenbaum, who is the professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. She's also a past president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. As I said, she's a former training director of the Child and Adolescent Fellowship at Columbia University. And she is the co-founder of Caring, which is a program for the arts and preventative mental health that goes into the schools for children in New York that I worked with a long time ago. Welcome, Dr. K.
Thank you so much.
So the reason that I wanted to have you on the show and that I wanted you to be the first is because I feel like my relationship to psychoanalytic theory and to seeing patients comes very much from your vision about how to see patients and how to relate to their inner worlds. In fact, I don't know if you remember, but when I graduated from the psychoanalytic center, I called you my psychoanalytic fairy godmother.
Yes, I remember.
And we talk a lot about fairy tales together. And in fact, you've written a paper, which I really enjoyed when I was in training. And that, for me, one of the reasons that I became a child psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst is because of the book, The Uses of Enchantment by Bruno Bettelheim. And you have written about the importance of fairy tales as well. One of your articles talks about the importance of looking at girls in fairy tales. And I think that's a very interesting topic. I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell, who's written the Hero's Journey and, you know, Star Wars was based on. And he focuses primarily on that myth. He talks about girls, but not as much as boys. But you talk about the importance that fairy tales have and the myths have for girls and women. Can you say something about that?
Yes. Fairy tales are the most important literature in the world. They've gone through hundreds, maybe thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And the fairy tales are the same in every culture. It depends on the child's developmental age. And therefore, I think it's so wonderful for a fairy tale that has incredible monsters and ogres and dragons. And at a certain age, the little boy wants to conquer them. And he goes through a certain life experience where it's really, really, really important. For girls, the fairy tales have usually been where she's a princess and will be rescued and live forever in a happy castle. I mean, think of the fairy tales for years, like Cinderella, Beauty and the Beast is simply a fantastic one about leaving your father and going to a new love that is your own home. Although they don't throw away the father, he comes to live with them. Fairy tales are like dreams for children, and they're terribly, terribly important.
Do you ever see people in real life or maybe patients or anything where you think this is a fairy tale, that they're living out a fairy tale?
Many times they're living in a fantasy. And it was very interesting. A psychiatrist, Dick Gardner, wrote a book called Fairy Tales for the Real World. And I thought it was a horrible book because in this, and I told him many times, in this one, the little girl who dreamed of being a princess in Cinderella, she doesn't. She goes up. She realizes that she's not going to find Prince Charming. She goes to business school. She learns to be a typist or a secretary or a teacher. Uh-huh. And eventually she marries the boy next door and lives happily ever after. Nobody wants to read mm-hmm. the story like that.
No. Yeah. I have, particularly some young women, I have been able to use actual fairy tales, particularly I would say Sleeping Beauty is one. I have said, you are living your life like Sleeping Beauty. You're doing nothing, you're paralyzed, and you're waiting for a man to show up and wake you up. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we've talked about, you don't say this to everyone. You have to say it to someone who you have a relationship with, who understands it. But when you're on the same page, when I've said this, these young women agree 100%. They're able to use the image of Sleeping Beauty and the mythic sense of the fairy tale to understand themselves.
I think that's so important. I have a case right now of a woman who's quite young. She's 30. She has two children, married, but in a very, very contentious and unhappy marriage. So they're going through divorce. Mm-hmm. And I said to this woman, you've been like Sleeping Beauty mm-hmm. with the husband, the children, not your own life. You never followed your career or what you wanted to do. You have every opportunity now of having a whole new life and finding yourself on all those dormant years. Not that you weren't a good mother and did things, but that was not the life that you wanted. You were, your inner life was dormant, sleeping. So I do believe in myth and metaphor.
You really see it show up in life sometimes, don't you?
Very, very many times. I think it's very, very different for girls and boys, because boys have gone through a period where they want to fight dragons. They're usually 5 or 6 years old, 7 years old, and they're so interested in action and winning and being number one. Girls have not had that. It's only lately with Wonder Woman mm-hmm. and other superheroes who are women. Although there, of course, was Amazon literature, Greek literature, but much, much less. The usual fairy tale for a girl is that she is a girl who is suffering a great deal, like Cinderella or Snow White, with a wicked stepmother, and she runs away and she gets a lot of help. But very often, she goes into what we consider in psychoanalysis the latency period, where nothing is happening, everything is latent, and she's awakened in what seems to be puberty, or seen by Prince Charming. And Bettelheim talks about this a great deal. But the girls that I've seen very often have had the fantasy of that they can't really compete in math or in science, which is not true at all. And that they really, it's culturally determined in so many ways, that they're there to have the family, to be by the hearth. The men are going out to fight and conquer and bring in the food, and they're going to be at home taking care of the children.
Do you think that the fairy tales are fostering that kind of passivity, or do they offer some way of thinking or understanding ourselves that liberates us, that can liberate us?
Well, it's funny, because when times change, the nature of the fairy tale changes mm-hmm. also. And it has changed a lot for girls. Now, so many girls will think of themselves as their mothers and really identify very much, which is quite normal and common to identify with a mother. If the mother has a very good feeling about her identity and herself, let's say as a professional woman or a working woman or one who's very active in the world, the girl will have a very different feeling about herself. If she sees the mother as passive, or as in so many instances, abused or bullied by a husband, and she's going to have that image of herself. So the fairy tales in many cultures reflect the cultural reality mm-hmm. of what they're through. And that is changing a great deal. Certainly in our culture, in Western culture, it is changing a great deal. And girls have a very, very different role. But the old-fashioned fairy tales, it could also be fairy tales involving a Goldilocks who has to get lost and has to make choices, and sometimes makes good choices and sometimes bad. And certainly Sleeping Beauty is very, very common, where it's a wonderful girl at home. And all these stories, whether it's King Lear, whether it's from Shakespearean, whether we have a father who the girl takes care of and has to really save and rescue. But how is that girl going to have a life of her own and really discover her power, her creativity, herself, her identity? So often it has been in, and I have to say, in Freudian psychoanalysis also, it's a male-centered focus always. And it was only much later that women with the feminist movement began to challenge this and say, Freud, whom I happen to admire enormously and love so many of his ideas, did not understand two things. He did not understand music at all, couldn't understand the feeling for it, that affect, that emotion. He just didn't have it. And he didn't understand women at all. And so it was only much later that it was all male-dominated psych. Not that there weren't wonderful things in it, and I would never throw out the baby with the bathwater and throw out Freudian concept, but he did not understand women in the way that the modern women psychoanalysts do and have.
That's so interesting. I feel the same way about Freud. And in fact, doing this podcast has made me more aware of an affection that I have for him. And I had not realized like how I feel towards him. But he does have this reputation among many people as being rigid and sexist and saying terrible things about women, and they just want to get rid of him. So how do you for yourself kind of justify those two sides of Freud when you think about
it? Well, because nobody is perfect.
Exactly.
And I think that the Freud's discovery, or I should say he didn't only discover it, but he really contributed so greatly to the understanding of the unconscious, that we have another mind, that we have another soul, a psyche that has nothing to do with our external behavior in reality, but has to do with our inner feelings, and that those feelings that children have from the beginning can be suppressed or repressed, which means you can either consciously not think about them, deny their existence, or push them away, or repressed, meaning you really have like a dissociative state, you don't remember them at all unless it comes out. However, these forces are very, very important. And I think Freud did an incredible job in bringing this and also bringing the nature of metaphor, of dreams, of fantasy in some of his wonderful, brilliant writings, that he didn't understand certain emotional states, that he didn't understand women not very well. Yes, that's true. But then other people can come and take what's really wonderful and important and basic and say, but we're going to add on now. That has to do with relationships with the other person, the ego psychology, different, I would say post-Freudian views that happen to be very prominent in the psychoanalytic center at Columbia, where you and I both train.
I want your opinion. You know, people say he, especially now, you know, with the allegations of sexual harassment that are coming out and people really looking at what women have had to go through now, but throughout history, that Freud, you know, hated women or put them down. And that's not my feeling.
I don't think he hated women at all. He had people, he loved his mother. He absolutely adored his daughter.
Anna. I think that Freud not only loved his daughter, but he respected her very much as well, her mind and her contribution. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he was so brilliant in trying to understand the unconscious life and fantasies of his patients, the ones that he did see, that he wrote the case histories about. And I think they're tremendously important. For example, people say, well, there's no such thing as penis envy. This is not true. If you see any nurse in a nursery, you go to any school, or you see any child of a parent, the little boy is running around with his penis, peeing on the flowers, writing his name in the snow, and the little girl can't do that. And does she not envy that? This is all from Margaret Mahler. Yes, she does, for a moment. And the mother, who is a good mother, will say, well, of course, he's a boy. He has a penis, and you're a girl, and you have a vagina, and his penis is outside, so you can see it. Your vagina is more hidden; it's inside, but it has the same feeling, And one day you'll have breasts and you'll have a baby. And but the little girl doesn't want that. She wants the penis at that moment. But it's very important for the mother to understand that and to say, but you have a vagina. Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues had a little girl of two, and she was very, very jealous of her cousin, who was chasing her around in the bathtub. They were taking a bath together and laughing and giggling, and she couldn't do it. And the mother explained that. The mother was a lawyer and a very wonderful professional, wonderful mother, and also a wonderful woman. So the girl saw her mother being very active in the world and very confident with herself. And her father also was a physician and doing beautifully. But the mother said, so the next day in the elevator of their building, this is a family that wanted to have unisex. They wanted to have no blue and pink, just yellow or white. So she was in her little bunny suit. And the doorman said, oh, what a sweet, darling little boy you are. She said, I'm not a boy. I have a vagina. It was a wonderful. This same little girl, the parents really did not want her to grow up with the fairy tale images of the princess mm-hmm. Sleeping Beauty being awakened by a man. They wanted her to have her own identity, like the mother did. So they didn't give her a doll. They gave her a tool set with a hammer and a nail, you know, a play school tool set. And the interesting thing was that the cousin, they didn't want him just to have masculine images, so they gave him a doll. And what happened, they came home one day and the children were playing. They were both three. The little girl had taken her hammer and wrapped a blanket around it and was holding it. Mm-hmm. And the little boy took the doll and was using it as a hammer to hammer the tool set. So that even with the best intentions, you know, there is such a thing. There's also a great difference biologically that girls are more social, more verbal, more sensitive. This is in so many studies for many, many years, where boys are more active and, you know, more assertive. I won't even use the word aggressive, but it has to do with assertion and has a higher, stronger motor-wise. And there have been tons of experiments with this. Now, the thing about nurses who know the difference, they know that little boys have discovered their penis and they're going to play with it. Why did all the German children have to have their tans folded on the table on top or on top of the covers, as if they're not thinking that there is a self-stimulation, that there is masturbation? Everybody knew. Freud was considered a dirty old man because, look, he's bringing what everybody sees and knows to consciousness, to awareness, I should say. And people said, no, look at its sexual perversion. Not at all. I mean, think of castration anxiety. Little boys were told that their thumbs would be cut off if they played with themselves or masturbated. And it's so important that so many symptoms came from having to repress these completely normal, natural urges. It's particularly important when symptoms develop in adolescence with children who have had that either from religious point of view or very strict upbringing, and a boy will have a nocturnal emission and think something horrible has happened or is something terrible, that he's either being poisoned, something bad is happening to him.
I think that talking about gender is such an interesting topic academically, but also it's so important socially, always, and always evolving, particularly now. You know, I said in one of my episodes, I grew up in the 80s, and I feel like sometimes I look back completely with nostalgia and my own bias, but I feel like the pop culture images that we had mm-hmm. of women at that time were the best that anyone had ever had, you know? Yeah. And it's all gone downhill from then. I've since had this discussion with millennial young women, yes. and they've educated me about mm-hmm. the role models that they mm-hmm. have now. But I wanted to ask you about your own experience and what it was like for you. You went to medical school in Israel, is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I remember, I hope you'll tell the story, one story you have of taking your physics exam. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Can you tell that story?
Well, no, it was during the
war.
The war. Well, there was a huge amount of, we were in the no man's land in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I remember very much. And I heard pop, 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 pop. And I thought it was just, I didn't know what it was, you know. And I see my physics professor rushing down from the building. We didn't have Hadassah Hospital then, did not exist. It was on Mount Scopus, which was in Arab hands at the time. And Ain Karim, the new medical center, wasn't built yet. He was running. I said, but I have to take, I'm going back to America tomorrow. And for the summer, and I didn't take my physics exams, and he yells at me, "You got an A."
What
happened?
What made you decide to do your training there?
Well, it wasn't exactly like that. My mother was a concert pianist and a wonderful teacher and a wonderful role model for me in mm-hmm. so many ways. My father was a physician who was came over at the age of six, brought in steerage with his mother because his father had come 5 years earlier to America. They were from Austro-Hungary, you know, Galicia, and to make a life as a tailor and then send for them. So he had this one who came over, then they moved to, it's a whole long story, which I won't go into now, about how they got to Denver. Mm-hmm. And he was the first graduate of Denver. It was University of Colorado. Now it was called, you know, and he was the first, certainly the first Jewish graduate ever.
That's your father?
My father, and the youngest one. And he was 26 years old. And in those years, you know, people, it was so easy. They followed a surgeon around or a general practitioner around, et cetera. He went to his 50-year reunion. There were 12 of them left. He was very famous. He had gone to Los Angeles and discovered treatments for syphilis and gonorrhea that nobody had then before penicillin. The number one student in the class had died of alcoholism. He mm-hmm. was a drunk, had become. But Dad was very famous, and he got an award the year I graduated medical school as Humanitarian of the Year. Mm-hmm. But what I had done, I was simply a pianist, and I studied literature, English literature, and music. But I was not nearly as talented as my mother or as my sister, who was a world-famous violist, mm-hmm. studied with Primrose, gave concerts, was fantastic. I knew that I was good. I studied in Paris for a year, my year abroad, but I was not great. And I knew that I would be a very good teacher, but I wanted more. And I went to an analyst, Dr. Leo Rangel, and
very
I was
well known.
Very famous, wonderful in Los Angeles. I had wonderful stories about the treatment. He wrote a paper about me
called Adolescence.
I was 19. I didn't know what I wanted to do. He helped me understand that I could be a doctor if I wanted. Nobody wanted, even my parents were very upset. This is terrible and then I wanted to be a psychiatrist. That was even worse. I mean, they didn't tell anybody for a couple of years. No, you're a pianist, you're a literature, you're art, you know, music. But what happened to me was really very, very important. Two things, my personal life. When I came back from Paris to play before my mother, and I had played beautifully, late Beethoven sonatas and marvelous Chopin ballades. My fingers froze. I could not play. They literally were paralyzed. I couldn't believe it myself. And my mother said something like, I always knew you couldn't make it, or something negative. But there was nobody at home. It was just my mother, my father, maybe the maid. You know, I was playing. And a friend of mine, I said, my God, he said, wait a minute. We have a wonderful doctor, Dr. Leo Rangel. That's how I got to him. And it was very, very important for me to switch my identity from being a musician as a career. I always kept up as an avocation, and to one that I really wanted to do, because I had just discovered Freud. I just read the literature. How I got to Israel was a little different. I was a great Zionist, so I went to a Zionist camp, but I wasn't thinking of going to Israel. But I married the Hillel rabbi. He was the youngest rabbi ever that had been ordained in the Reform movement. And he was going to Israel to get a PhD. No, he was going to England. We went to England. But his professor was killed by a bus, and the only other medieval scholar, it was medieval Jewish literature that he wanted to study, was in Jerusalem. So that's how I got to Jerusalem.
I see.
But once I was in Jerusalem, his friend helped me get in by simply protexia, they called it. it was simply calling up a friend and say, there's an American young woman here and she wants to go to medical school. The medical school was 6 years. It was like the European. Yeah. That's why I had to repeat physics and chemistry. I had to repeat trigonometry. I mean, I had to have a tutor for everything because I was totally stupid in those things. I mean, just that's why I know that if a normal person, if they're motivated, can do anything because I could do it. And I had, and then I went into, you know, I did horribly in physiology and some things. I always had help. But once I got to the clinical years, I was very, very good and very talented. And remember, our professors were from Germany, from Poland, from Russia, world famous people. But I got a divorce from my husband then and returned to UCLA. In Israel, there were 25 women out of 50 in the class, and they had all been in the Army, and they were all tough, and they were all just wonderful. When I went to UCLA, unbelievable prejudice against women. Four women in the class, all ugly. You shouldn't be a doctor. You should be home. Mm-hmm. You're taking the place of a man. You're just going to have babies. It was very horrible for all of us, but particularly for me. You had another career. You didn't need it. It was very, very difficult. Not the work. I had had a great training in Israel, but because they were so angry and they did terribly sexist things, horrible things. But I was very tough and I was able to, you know, withstand it. And getting the residency was so easy. I applied at all the places on the East because I knew the East Coast had the best programs. And you just went in, saw people. I got a call from Dr. Kolb when I was an intern, surgical intern at the VA, said, hey, you want to come to Columbia? Well, just come, you're in. I mean, it was the processes were so easy then.
The story of your getting to Israel, your own analysis of medical school is so interesting. And there's many things that I want to ask about that, but let me narrow it down to two. Religion and culture, the ways that we as our individual selves are affected by and relate to our cultures and how it shapes us is so interesting. And just to bring it back to your observation that in Israel, however long ago, half of your medical school class were women.
53 to 58.
Who were, I mean, I assume there was some sexism, but mostly they were there and
there
they
really
were treated.
Wasn't.
How do you understand that? And I'll tell you something from my little experience going abroad to medicine. You know, I did a exchange in Russia because
yes.
Columbia had a exchange there. And I went with this very pretty blue-eyed blonde girl who was the daughter of one of the surgeons at Columbia, and she was graduating and she was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. Now, this was in the mid-90s when it still was not common for women to go into surgery, but they were. And she went to Russia, didn't speak a word of Russian. It was amazing to see her because she was sort of the one that no one took that seriously, but she did orthopedic surgery. She went to Russia. She was, at the end of it, she was hailing cabs and haggling about the price after like a month of there. I mean, she really kind of came into her own. But we showed up to a group of, you know, Russian doctors, and they introduced us as the American medical students. And, you know, John Burton is going to be going into psychiatry and Heidi is going to be going into orthopedic surgery. The entire room burst out laughing because they thought it was a joke that she was going into surgery. And one of the medical students, a woman medical student, came up to us afterwards and said, we have a saying in Russia, a woman who is a surgeon is neither a woman nor a surgeon.
Amazing.
And this was, I mean, it was long ago now, but it's not that long ago compared to your experience in Israel. And so I'm just curious your own observations having been through that. What do you think makes the difference?
Well, this is a cultural thing. Here, the women, first of all have to go to the Army. That doesn't mean they're all fighting, but they're aspects of the Army. Some became fighter pilots. The women who would make it to university and school, I had people in my class who had been in the Warsaw Ghetto. I had people who were in Siberia taking gold out of the teeth of students. The most amazing people who came, some of them kinder transport, their parents had been killed in Auschwitz. I mean, we had people that suffered. But in order to make it to the university and to the medical school, they had to have incredible strength and resilience, and they all did.
Well, this gets us to the topic of resilience, which I want to get to. But what I'm hearing in that is that that when you have been through difficulties and disaster and hardship, you can't afford that attitude.
Well, it certainly was true for my class, and they were really tough and wonderful. I was so shocked when I came to UCLA and I saw the difference. You know, people who hadn't suffered, who hadn't been, and where the sexism was so rampant.
Well, you know, it just, maybe the stereotype, or even looking, you know, scripturally and historically, the injunctions about men and women being together, you know, comes from Hebrew scripture.
Yeah.
And so how do you understand that development?
Listen, it's so, Iranian women were before, you know, the revolution
yeah.
and the
Islamic
revolution,
the Islam, yeah.
this, before the Shah
yeah.
was left, were doctors and lawyers and very brilliant and very proficient and have long histories of this. German women also. I mean, so much of it was cultural.
I wanted to go back to the topic of resilience that came up with the people in Israel that had to go through all of these things. But then in America, when you were in medical school, there were you four women who had to put up with so much. How did you do that?
It was hard. It was very hard. I had very good friends in the class. They were men, boys. Men, and we worked together. We studied boards together. We did things together. And with a couple of, well, one of the women, you know, friend, and with the men, and I just laughed about it. I've been to a place that's been so wonderful and different, and I come here, and this is really silly. I had the same thing in analytic school. I was one of 12, the only woman. And I used to laugh when they would give some of the lectures. You know, especially they would talk with feminine things, where they talk about penis envy as a lasting thing, as something that's built in. And I would just laugh. And I remember some of the teachers were so furious with me because, and especially they would talk about a vaginal or a clitoral orgasm. And here are men talking and knowing nothing. And I'm just sitting there thinking, this is ridiculous. They don't even know what they're talking about, you know, but...
But you were you had perspective, like you could see outside of what was going
yeah.
on here. But that requires a lot of strength to be able to do that, it seems to me.
Well, but strength, you know, there's the gene environment interaction. You have to have genetic predisposition. There are some people that no matter what happens with the most horrible things in life, they're happy, and each day is another day, and they're happy. And others, no matter the millionaires' kids on living. Who are depressed and miserable and unhappy and almost like Oblomov, you know, you don't even know, they can't enjoy anything.
Yeah.
And some of that is, it's very difficult because there's always an interaction, but there's also a big genetic predisposition to the resilience. People strive for life. We're not a death-oriented. Oh, that's one thing I never believed one minute, the death instinct.
Yeah.
Never. I believed, you know, that in the life instinct and that people can get, you know, the aggression can take over, and when there's no bonding early on and no attachment, that's a whole other story. But no,
well,
I never believed
that.
Just, in death.
That's my third testament, which is the birthright of goodness. This I did not learn in my training. I think I got it from, I won't blame you, but I think I got some of it from you, that I have to look at people as at their default. They're trying to do their best. They're trying to be good. They're trying to strive for life and growth. And that if they're not, something must have happened along the way. And if people can realize that when they're interacting with each other, particularly with children, but with each other all the time, that maybe they might be that person who was able to stop and listen and say, you're doing something really problematic, offensive, maybe even, but I wonder what's going on inside you that's making you do that. Maybe that's a point where that person might be able to change paths.
I have a story to tell you that I've never really talked about, but I think I'd like to talk about it
oh,
now.
Please.
I was a good student, very good, at Uni High in California, in Los Angeles, and I was head of the SPQR, the Latin Club. And that was, and I had a wonderful teacher who was a nun who never, of course, married, very, very religious, and a very brilliant woman who went every year to Japan or traveled to other places, very religious, but didn't wear a habit, but was our teacher. And one day, and I remember very, very well, I was 14. And she came to me and she said, my name was, I had changed it from Clarissa to Clarice then. Clarice, she said, I'm very, very worried about you. I said, well, I was getting straight A's and I was head of the Latin club. Why? She said, because you're going to go to hell because you're a Jew. And I said, I'll say her name is Miss Smith. It's not. I said, no, I don't. Jews don't believe in heaven and hell in the same way. And I don't really think I'm going to go to hell. She says, yes, you will. The best you could do is purgatory. And I so worry about your soul. And I said, Miss Smith, you know, we Jewish people believe in life right here and now. And I don't really believe that, you know, although I'm so happy that you know, that you're telling me this. But she said, you must convert. And I said, no, I don't think I'll convert. But in my mind, I knew that I wanted to go to Israel and build a country of where people would not have to say, you have no country and you're going to go to hell. But what I did was very wonderful now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I told no one, not my mother, not my father, not a friend, because think about it nowadays, if a teacher went, and think of if a parent went, you know how they would throw out
of course,
a teacher
yeah.
like that, and she might influence others. But I knew she didn't feel that way about everybody, maybe just me. And whatever it was, I knew that she was kind and loving, and I didn't want to hurt her, even when she said something that I did not in 1 minute believe. But I knew if I told anybody, she could be in terrible trouble, maybe not in those years. But certainly nowadays, you can imagine.
Of course.
And would a teacher be allowed or able to say anything like that? But I kept that because I knew she was a good woman and meant that. But her religion was so important, and she believed in the dogma totally. But I had the sense not to want to hurt her or say anything. So I never told anybody for maybe 30 years.
Somehow you were able to hear this bad thing, you're going to go to hell. I mean, I can't imagine worse.
Or purgatory.
You know, I mean, if you believe in hell, it's worse. But you were able to hear this directed at you, but see the person as still a good person.
Very,
you could
yeah.
hold the good and the bad together. Again, this is my Melanie Klein episode of
yes.
the paranoid schizoid versus the depressive.
Which
you were not in the paranoid schizoid position. You could see there was good and bad in this person. But that, again, is something I think that is very hard to do, and we have to, A, know that it's something to strive for, and B, we have to practice it. And I'm curious what you think from your own experiences, and I know that you're somebody who's always looking to the future and looking at development and gets excited by things moving forward and growing and wants to keep that happening. What do you think of, or what would you say to people who are struggling with these issues now in society, in school, in politics, with, as you said, if a teacher said something like that, or even less, you know, I've heard of teachers getting in trouble or fired for less. I had a case of a music teacher who happened to be gay. This, you will be surprised at the outcome. A gay parent went to him and said, I don't want you to teach the children a song that has mothers in it because my child doesn't have a mother and it will make him feel bad.
It's just a song, Daddy.
And the school was like, you know, you're right. And the music teacher was in terror of, and he was gay himself. So it can really be taken to an extreme, right?
Yeah.
We want people to have equal opportunity and to not deal with obstacles if they don't have to make things fair. How do you think about all of this? This is a genuine question. I don't have an answer to it.
Well, nobody has an answer, but I think you have to deal with reality as mm-hmm. well as your fantasy. You have to, the word moral compass comes up a lot nowadays. People have to have a sense of morality. They have to have a sense for themselves of what's right and wrong. And if they see something going on in the country, let's say you're a youth in Nazi Germany, or you're in the Deep South where people are hanging blacks. What if you decide, like Mark Twain with Tom Sawyer, He said, I know I'm doing the wrong thing by stealing Jim, but I feel that he shouldn't, he misses his wife and his children, and a man shouldn't own another man, so I'm a bad person in stealing him, but I'm stealing him anyway. Because mm-hmm. he has such a higher sense of morality, that Kohlberg sense of morality, you know, in terms of a higher level. And it's very important when a person has that to be able to do something with it. So when you're working with somebody and you see that they have a true moral compass and you see that it may not be exactly what's going on in the society at the moment, let's say conscientious objectors from any war, they can turn that into something very important and very good. What if you're just an average citizen and you're not happy with the way the world is? There are things you can write about, your things you can join. There are movements you can do. You can be very important in the voting process, in the electoral system. You do your best for society, not only for yourself. And I'm afraid that that's very hard to look at nowadays because there are so many things that are going on in the world. With the internet, we know so much more. Mm-hmm. I think there were always horrible things going on. We just didn't know about it. We know about it in 1 minute. It doesn't take 3 months for a letter to get somewhere. We know about it, and there are some wonderful things about the internet and some terrible things because of the rapidity and the things that can happen. But we're here. We're in this world. We need to use it. We need to use it well. And I think people can join other people with similar views, and they can do it in a very meaningful way. I do it by doing as much teaching as I can, you know, just in terms of the psychodynamic teaching and training. Other people who are in the world, who are journalists, who are reporters, who can write about things or just be political, can do it that way. But you want to live your life in a way that's not hiding and not avoiding, but doing something. I think that's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. How about when you encounter someone who says something that is personally offensive to you or is hurtful to you, like, you know, like this teacher did?
Yes.
And, you know, we do live in a different world where, well, you know, maybe we don't. I don't know. We're living in a split world, I think.
It's very split. I think you just have, it's very important not to react in anger and rage, but to say, I'm really sorry you feel that way. We have very different opinions.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, as Michelle Obama said,
when they go low, we go high.
It's taking.
I think that's really important.
It's a beautiful statement. Yeah. And it's not just about, it's not trying to be like Jesus, you know, it's just not stooping down to that level.
Right.
And because it hurts us, too, if we do that.
And, you know, people, if you try to do your best, you try to do, if you can help somebody in a small way, if you see a fight going on, if people hurting each other, et cetera, you report it, you call, you do something, even if you're too weak to go out and do it something yourself. Mm-hmm. You make sure something is done then. And you try to help as many ways, whether it's a school or whether it's a political organization or a neighbor. You know, people who are not trusting and are very paranoid, it's very difficult to work with them or have them as neighbors or have them around. But you try not to fall into the trap. Now, it's very hard to teach kids this who will fight on the bus or say a bad word or blame each other, et cetera. That's part of, you know, sort of latency period. But by adolescence, you're hoping that they will be able to deal with it better. And by adult life, you really hope. But, you know, how many people are not able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
But you, as a human being, you do your best as part of your life.
Yeah, yeah. I want to just ask you one or two more questions. You know, the Harvey Weinstein thing. A new report just came out against, or allegations came out against the journalist Mark Halperin. Did you see that?
I saw that.
Yeah. Well, he was a classmate of mine from college, yes.
Really?
And I didn't know him personally, but I saw him interviewed. So all of this stuff is coming out. What? And it's very hard
John,
to kind of look at it.
John. Yeah. What is the rape of the Sabines? It's been here forever.
Mm-hmm.
When was it not here? It's just that because men in power have been able to do this for years and women have not complained about it because they were worried about their job or the person in power, it's so important to have respect for the both sexes mm-hmm. and for parents to teach that. But what's coming out is so not new. Listen, when I was living in California, well, yeah, I was a child. I was 14. I was just getting pubertal and, you know, And my grandmother, who spoke only Yiddish and lived in Santa Monica, knew that I had to take a bus home, and not a car. Everybody in L.A. had cars, of course, but, you know, we didn't have a car to take me, I think, from my house to a dancing lesson or something like that. Or I forgot what, but the bus. And my mother didn't want me to go on the bus because of the perverts. There are all these people. They could expose themselves. They could do these things. And in L.A. and Hollywood, I mean, anything was good. To this day, anything goes. And so my grandmother, speaking only Yiddish, said, it's easy to solve that problem. She said to me, all you have to do is wear a hat. I said, well, why would I wear a hat? She says, because in the hat, there is a hat pin. And she taught me at a very early age, men are like this. If you see this, you know, stick them. And I had a little girl in treatment years later, of course. She was 10, and she was at a very fancy school in Riverdale, you know, a very, very lovely school, et cetera. And the school called up. What happened was that there was a man sitting in the car in front of the school exposing himself. So, you know, they're calling the police, and here's this man. And the mothers at school had to say, stay away. This little girl walks up to the window, she's my patient, and says to the man, Mister, you need help. You should see Dr. Kestenbaum. She'll help you with your problem. And I thought, and the mother called me. I said, listen, you don't have to worry one drop about your little girl.
You know, it doesn't surprise me. I guess it's bringing up a conversation that sometimes is very hard to read. A lot of my practice is young men. I am seeing a trend of these men, and again, I can't say it's all men or anything, but they are feeling so bad. Like they feel that society may look at girls and say, you're inadequate, you're not good enough, you're weak. They feel that they look at them as men or having a penis as being bad. There's something inherently wrong with them. Even now, a couple, more than one, have said, I feel like if I allow myself to be ambitious in my career, or to, you know, be going after the women that I might see, that I'll be like Donald Trump. Like they get so inhibited because of these images and the way that media kind of talks about.
Well, look, some women are horrible with them, make them feel inadequate or lecherous, or write books about their inadequacy. And I have a number of young men like that, too, in the practice. And there is a terrible, you know, there is a backlash. And it's very important to develop their own sense of themselves, their own self-esteem, their own inherent goodness. And if they're with a woman like that, they should leave immediately. Mm-hmm. Or the same thing with a woman with a man. Yeah. They'd walk away. But look at this thing. President Bush, 93 years old, in a wheelchair, and he pats the buddy's bottom. Now, is that the most ridiculous thing to say, this is a sexual assault?
I'm glad that you're saying that, because I don't think that I could have the same authority in saying that. But that was my impression. Where was she annoyed by how? I don't know what her perspective was
just
on this.
Walk away, you know, or pat him back. I mean, it's an old 93-year-old man.
It seems like, where are we drawing the line? And but it's not just a woman here or a woman there. It's men and women, and it's sort of society. And I think when you see a headline that says men are shaking in their boots, it kind of makes me want to say, well, it's really not all men, and it's not even most men. So no. You probably want to change, you know, the headline there.
Yeah, the whole men are from Mars, women are from Venus, the whole myth, the whole what is male, what is female. To tell you the truth, I don't think we understand one single thing since Adam and Eve, and I mean literally from Adam and Eve. Is woman evil, giving the apple? Was it the serpent? Mm-hmm. Did man just give in to her? What happened? You know, there, no one, including Freud, like, what do women want? Well, what do men and women want? You know, the truth is, nobody knows. That's what I think. Everybody has a theory, and everybody has a new idea. And I think we're just as clueless as anything in this. We just have to shuffle along and try, you know, what we can do, because people don't know. What we can do is try to understand the other person, try to understand your role. Try to understand yourself. It's very hard for some people to look in the mirror.
Yes.
And see, I love our profession because it is one that says, let's examine,
mm-hmm.
you know, better than, there are wonderful professions in theology and literature, wonderful. But I think, you know, I felt lucky, and I think you do too, to be in our profession mm-hmm. and see, look, we see everything. We see a million stories. We're great novelists in our heads. We see, yeah. you know, so much. How lucky to be able to do that.
Yes, we are. I just want to say what I hear where you end is an embracing of uncertainty, that we don't have to know everything
and
that we just have to try.
Yeah.
That's really beautiful. Thank you so much, Dr. Kestenbaum.
You're very welcome.
This is Dr. JKB signing off. Just as a listener, anything that you would want to pull out or focus around?
There was a section there that I had a question when you were telling your story about how you ended up in Israel with your husband. Then you got a divorce. As a journalist, I would have just jumped in.
Yeah. Right?
What happened there? Yeah. But
he ran away with a blonde, if you want to know what really happened.
Since we are exploring together, you make the journey all the richer by subscribing to the show on iTunes. And even better, if you also leave a rating, it helps others to find us. If you have a story about how the concept in this episode helped you figure out something in your life, send it in, please. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter at Psychonaut Show. Show notes are on the website, thepsychonautshow.com. And if you leave me a question, it may well be an inspiration for an upcoming episode. Until our next trip, judge nothing, question everything, and remember, there's always a reason. Bye for now. All the patient stories presented on the Psychonaut Show are created by me to illustrate an idea. Any resemblance to actual people is purely coincidental. The Psychonaut Show was created and produced by yours truly, John Burton. Art and web design by Hunter Creative. Post-production and sound design by Julio Gonzalez of Zimmer Media. Zimmer Media can be found online at zimmer.co. That's Ximer.co.